Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Faith Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. Today, we have another installment of the mini-series Spiritual Watering Holes, the idea taken from the subtitle of the 8th chapter of the Gibbons book, The Crucible of Doubt. We are encouraged to find our watering place. Sometimes, maybe often, the banality and the mundane nature of weekly church, or perhaps weekly church with small children, or weekly church listening to other people's small children, doesn't exactly feed us like we need in a spiritual sense. So we need to find our source of spiritual sustenance and drink and be whole again beyond confusion. In fact, Proverbs 5:15 exhorts us to drink water from our own cistern, flowing water from our own well. We need to be spiritually independent, and accomplishing that requires exploration of different practices. So in this episode, the exploration we undertake is with Michael Barker and Sarah Collette as they share their experience with their own meditation practices. One minor disclaimer, the very end of this discussion gets cut off a bit abruptly. The joy of being Mormon is often coupled with the experience of children and needing their parents. So we got interrupted a little bit and weren't able to end our conversation with the grace and fluidity and dynamism that we normally do here. Just kidding. Despite that minor hiccup, I'm sure you'll enjoy the sharing of experiences. So, let's get to it. All right, well, I have two wonderful people for another segment, another edition of the Spiritual Watering Holes ideas. I have Sarah Collette.
Hello.
And Mike Barker.
Hello.
Both Sarah and Mike, they've been hooked on some sort of meditation. And so we're going to talk about that. And I think you guys both have sort of different types, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll get two different flavors of meditation. But to start off, as usual, most of the listeners, you'll know Mike Barker from Rational Faith blog and Sarah Collette from A Thoughtful Faith and a little bit of Exploring. Did you do Exploring Sainthood at all?
I think I have one podcast on Exploring Sainthood. I don't know if they have. I know they went through like a rebranding for a little while, and I don't know if they reposted it, but good one. Good one on there.
You did a bunch on A Thoughtful Faith, and you've just recently did another one.
Yeah, I've done a couple. I'm going to release another one next week. And cool. Yeah, so just occasionally now, but I used to do it quite regularly.
Yeah, awesome. So that's who we have. So let's start off talking about what a spiritual experience is for you now. Like, you probably both think about things differently than when you were 12. So what is a spiritual experience for you?
You know, actually, because you mentioned 12, I actually have kind of gone back to that innocent view. I think, obviously, I've thought a lot more about it now and gone through quite an evolution. But I've really come back to just kind of transcendence, experiences that feel and that feel like they're coming from something bigger than me, outside of me, or at least my consciousness. Yeah.
So the things that are important are these sort of transcendent, overwhelming experiences.
Yeah, I do think.
Kind of like the girls' camp end of the week.
You know,
everyone's crying.
No, not at all.
Okay, so that's what I'm thinking about with 12-year-old is everyone around the campfire. I love you guys so much.
Yeah, no.
We'll always be together and, like, overwhelming emotions. So what do you mean by what kind of 12-year-old experience did you have?
I did have those 12-year-old experiences, but now that I'm much more honest and I'm not afraid of being honest about my spirituality, I faked most of those. To be honest, I conjured emotion because I felt like that was what was required. But, I mean, I felt that emotion, but it wasn't, I don't think it was what I'm talking about. I was probably, different than most 12-year-olds. I thought about things really deeply at a young age, and big ideas were really overwhelming to me. I think I had a lot of anxiety about the big ideas that I encountered in Mormonism, and I encountered those ideas really young. My dad was really open with us, and we talked doctrine from such a young age. I remember, so I would lay in bed a lot and be scared of the universe and the eternities. And I think I had probably, you know, a few of those moments laying in bed where I just felt, like for a moment, everything was so huge and so big, and it felt like something that wasn't, that I couldn't contain, if that makes sense. And I had little glimpses of that, and I always kind of clung to those. I think that was like the foundation of faith for me, was hoping that those experiences were real. And then, you know, of course, as I got older, I had much more specific transcendent experiences. Like I said, not often, but at times, and they were the ones, those are the ones that really, really shaped me. So, yeah, not the emotional crying, testimony bearing. I think I faked those more than anything.
You're reaching back now to kind of have that terrifying, overwhelming, like,
well, I think
like,
I'm...
this is really important, this is a really big deal, this idea, like, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess what I've gone back to is just, I love neurology, I love science, I love quantum physics, I love, you know, kind of the big ideas in science, and the mysteries of science are really fascinating to me. And so, having read a lot about that, I've found that I really, really reside in this idea that we are so much more than what we can comprehend. And I love ambiguity. I love the comfort of knowing that we don't know anything. And so I think that's always kind of been who I am. And so when I talk about going back to that, you know, place as a young girl, I think what I'm going back to is trying to find that wonder. And I always use the word transcendence, where I catch a glimpse of something so much bigger and more profound, and something that I feel isn't necessarily, like I can't contain it, that it's something bigger, it comes from some other place, divinity, whatever name you want to put on that. I mean,
like a sense of awe.
Yeah, a sense of awe. And I think that those experiences change me more, you know, they have an effect that lasts, and that actually, you know, kind of flows into other, like the action in my life. It affects how I treat people or think about the world, or how I look at other human beings, or how I, you know, treat my children even. That those bigger experiences give me perspective, and that somehow translates into the way I live. And so emotions and, you know, happiness, joy, all of those things are really beautiful emotions, but I always am kind of, I think when I think of spiritual experience, I'm looking for those moments that are really transcendent for me. And I think it's just because that's a way that I can really kind of separate my science brain from that deep need that I have to look for the divine, to look for things beyond our understanding. And emotions and all of that stuff, you know, you can read about it and study it and really reduce it to kind of these scientific terms. But those transcendent moments, those are still mysteries. And they're also, you know, even when they are explained by science, there's always this leap of faith, you know, to understand why our brain does what it does, or why we're having similar transcendent experiences. All those big questions are questions that I just feel, you know, are imprinted with hope in the divine. So I love that. That's kind of my take on it.
Cool. Yeah, I like that. I agree 100% on the peak experiences causing you to change in some positive way.
Yeah.
So Mike, tell us about yourself and how you think about spiritual experiences now.
You know, I knew this question was going to be asked. So I've been trying to come up with something succinct. So I'm not a terribly, I'm just not a spiritual person. I don't naturally incline towards that. And when I was a kid, there are moments I can remember feeling something and crying. Like I remember when I was a deacon living in East San Jose, my dad was on the bishopric, and somebody thought it would be a great idea to have me and two other deacons singing I'm a Child of God in sacrament meeting. Well, it was me, Chris Ruiz, and Danny Langevin. And Chris's mom played the piano for us. And afterwards, we were up there. And, well, Danny Langevin was known to be a goof-off. And, well, I for whatever reason, I followed his lead. And we were being horrible up there. And my dad couldn't see any of it because we were all behind him. But he got told about it after sacrament meeting. And I got in so much trouble. And then he told me that I had to go and apologize to the bishop. So I walked. He lived in our neighborhood, but way, way far down. So I walked over there, and I apologized. And I remember when I told him I was sorry, I had this, like, overwhelming feeling, like, rise up in my chest. And I just started bawling like a baby. And I think that – I don't think that manifested any type of truth, except that what it manifested was that I was doing something good and right. And so when I think about the Spirit, I kind of – there's the idea of it manifesting some type of objective truth to you, and then there's also the idea of, I think, of it manifesting that something is good. And I think in my life, when I think I recognize something that we would call the Spirit, I think it's manifesting goodness as opposed to some type of objective truth to me. And so that's why, I mean, I listened to the episode 2 of this series, and, you know, the Muppets got brought up because John DeLynn brought that up like years ago in one of his first podcasts, that he felt the same feelings, right, watching the Muppets. And I think it's just because, you know, the Muppets was manifesting something good, and I have no problem with that, but that doesn't mean that the Muppets were the one and only true show on Earth, you know. I don't think it
might be.
It could be. The most recent one was really funny, but so anyways, that's kind of how I view it. I think in my life it manifests goodness more than some type of objective truth. Once again, if you're doing something good in your life, I think it can do that. But I have no problem saying that it will help confirm some subjective truth, which I think I like how Kierkegaard split stuff, where he talks about objective truths, such as it's 76 degrees outside versus subjective truth, my wife loves me. The former gives my life zero meaning, the latter does, but both of them are true, you know. And yeah. So I think the Spirit can confirm the truth or the goodness of the latter, such as my wife loves me and God loves me and my children love me and there's goodness in Mormonism. That's kind of how I tend to frame things now.
That's excellent. Cool. That's good. You've kind of touched on this, but maybe you can answer quickly then. But Sarah, you kind of talked a little bit about emotions being different from a transcendent sense of awe type experience. So do you define the Spirit and emotional experiences as distinct, separate things, or do you see them tied up together or one and the same?
Well, can I be honest about this?
Yeah.
I don't know that I really think about the Spirit anymore. I appreciate the language, but I think it's taken on a really different... I mean, I've kind of moved in a different path. So
So you're not a dualist?
No. I feel like one of the things that I've really loved learning about is the evolution of our brains, the evolution of our psychology. And I've come to believe personally that we have evolved towards goodness that like empathy and compassion and altruism are actually part of our evolution. I read a really great book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, which I'd recommend
everybody.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that was one of those, like, you know how you always have a God gap, right? My God gap was like, well, yeah, but what about altruism? Or my husband's, that's my husband's big one too. And that book was so great because it said, oh no, look, here's how we evolved to be good human beings, to want and to crave goodness.
Right, and they observe empathy in mice
right.
as well.
There's all sorts of science that's coming out now that shows that we're not the only altruistic beings, and also they're also you know, psychology and is really going in the direction of helping us understand how, you know, altruistic characteristics actually do make us stronger in it from an evolutionary standpoint. And it usually has to do with group dynamic, which anyone wants to read about that, that's a really fascinating book. But anyway, so I feel like I really love the idea of the light of, you know, light of Christ, or kind of this inherent goodness. So I think if there, you know, if God is God, that whatever process that we went through to evolve to become human beings, it is built into that process that we are directed towards goodness, that there is something inherent in us that always points us in that direction. You know, of course, there are always going to be glitches in the system, and you're going to get your, you know, sociopaths and stuff like that. And I don't have answers for that. But I do feel like that there is this thing that we can rely on, that people do inherently have that pointer. And so when I think about the spirit now, it's more in that light. I feel like we really do have internal compasses, and that when we are quiet, when we are paying attention, when we are connecting to other human beings, we're always looking for meaning. We're always looking for reinforcement of that goodness, and because it makes us stronger and it makes us better able to form successful societies. And so I always think of it as just these tuning in to who we really are. From, you know, an evolutionary standpoint, a spiritual standpoint. So I don't necessarily think of, like, the spirit as this outside force that comes and, like, touches mm-hmm. us anymore. But so transcendence or the divine or that spiritual experience has to be something more than that, right? It has to be, for me, it's an act of faith. I always think of that spiritual experience as reaching out past that evolutionary point where we are looking for that goodness and feeling it and recognizing it, to connecting to the bigger, you know, the bigger universe, the bigger divine, the bigger picture, and kind of having an experience that is a little bit more than that. So anyway, does that make sense? Am I?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that makes total sense. And so if what I get from that is, when you were talking about the different emotions, like feeling happy or whatever, compared to transcendence, those are, the transcendent experience might be an emotional experience, but it's like a different flavor.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Definitely. And I think that the joy and the happiness and I think that is, you know, part of that internal compass. I think that that we have those emotions and even sometimes pain. I think, you know, we undervalue pain a lot, but I think that we're, you know, that we have all of those emotional, that emotional complexity to help us recognize that internal compass that we have. And so, the only word that I always kind of, you know, separate a little bit from that is love. I feel like love has a real transcendent quality to it. Something unexplainable. It has the ability to speak the language of every emotion. You know, love can be really, really intimately connected to almost every emotion that I have. So I don't know that I maybe reserve love for more transcendent experience than I would for just, like, emotional good experiences.
Yeah. Okay, great. Mike, what about you? Emotional experiences, spiritual experiences.
Yeah.
Those are always kind of a conundrum in people's minds.
Yeah. I think there's a qualitative difference to it. So when I feel the spirit, it comes as two ways. One is just kind of a calmness I have and a clarity and thought, especially if I'm like kind of wrestling with something, like I'll have like a clarity of what I should do. But there have been occasions, actually I can think of only one occasion, and I'll share it with you. So I was a young teenager, and our middle-aged brother was like five or six, and I was assigned to start the grill outside one summer. So I started, and I forgot, oh crap, I didn't clean the grill off. So I took the grill off, I scraped it off on the cement, and then put it back on there. Didn't think anything of it. And then a few minutes later, my little brother just starts screaming, bloody, just screaming. So I go outside, and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on, why he's screaming. So I just pick him up, and all of a sudden, this thought comes out of nowhere, stick his feet in cold water in the bathtub. It was like this, it was like so clear in my mind. So I did it, right? I stuck it, I mean, no reason for this. I stuck it in there. Well, what had happened was when I cleaned the grill off, the grill was hot, and so I had scraped up all these hot embers on the hot 100-plus degree Central Valley concrete. And my little brother had stepped on his bare feet on these hot embers. He ended up with like 2-degree burns on his feet because of it, you know. But I'm convinced that my quick reaction to do something that was completely illogical saved, you know, from having worse burns. And it was completely an illogical thing. And to this day, I'm convinced it was, you know, the divine telling me to do that. That's only happened once in my life. But usually it manifests itself as just very clarity of what I should do, or just complete peace. And it's completely different from emotion for me. And I'm kind of sensitive to my emotions being manipulated. That's why I hate, you know, sappy piano music and Mormon cinema. It just drives me crazy, you know, and things like that. So for me, there's a distinct quality. And to piggyback on what you said, Sarah, regarding Jonathan Haidt, one of my first blog posts that I wrote was the idea was, what was it called? That God is the foundation for objective morality. Yeah. And I made a good argument, and it really held up really well. And then I read Jonathan Haidt, and then he just kind of blew that away. because I was convinced that my apologetic thing, because one time I was really into natural theology, and I was convinced that this argument was not a God of the gaps. And then when I read Jonathan Haidt, I was like, oh, this is totally God of the gaps, and all this is explained by evolution. So I guess I shouldn't use God for that. So yeah. I'm not going to. So then, well, you bring the question. Yeah.
You know, I like that, though, because I think that we undervalue faith. But for me, closing all the gaps has just opened up all of the beautiful possibilities of faith. I don't think I ever really appreciated it, because I always felt so comfortable with the idea that we could have so much knowledge about God.
Yeah.
But once I finally kind of closed all that those doors on knowledge, I don't know. I feel like my understanding of faith is just becoming more and more beautiful, and also more and more powerful. So I don't know. I think it's good stuff,
well,
right?
Well, you know what? When Brian Dillman interviewed Peck, one thing that Peck said that really, like, it hit me pretty hard, is he said, you know, if you're using God just to kind of, like, if you're using him to explain creation, if you're using him to explain all this, he goes, eventually science is going to answer all those gaps.
Yeah.
So then, so why do you? So what's the deal with God? And he said that we should seek to have relationship with him. And I thought, that's beautiful, because that's Mormonism too, right? I mean,
yeah,
essentially, I mean, that's what sealings are doing, right? We're binding ourselves to each other and stuff in these relationships. And I think that's kind of one of the beautiful things that I still love about Mormonism is that it is ultimately about forming these relationships. Yeah.
I love that. I definitely feel like Peck had he was like monumental for me in terms of reshaping my God paradigm, because I think I let go of it for a while just to, you know, find out if I was an atheist. But I, he helped me so much because same thing. He kind of reinforced in me the need to, or he just basically gave me permission to acknowledge the desire that I had to know the divine, to know God, and to experience God. So that's really personal, and I love that, that, you know, in the end, that is what God is for me, is my personal experience with God. And, you know, I feel like there isn't a question or a test or a method that you can apply to that. It really just comes down to my personal experience and how I feel about the divine. And that makes it really, really, you know, founded in faith for me. So, yeah, I appreciate it. Good stuff.
All right, well, let's get to the way you guys try to connect with the divine or connect more deeply with yourself, which is some form of meditation. So, Sarah, what is your meditation called?
Christian centering prayer.
Okay, and Mike?
Well,
you don't even know.
No, it kind of started like Sarah's. It was actually a centering prayer. And now I'm just trying meditation for a while. But I kind of mix with the centering prayer, too. So I want to hear what Sarah does, and I want to compare notes.
All right.
Okay, cool. Because this is kind of a pop, to me, well, I guess, I don't know if it's popular, but it really struck a chord with me with some Mormon Matters episodes that Dan did with Phil McLemore.
Yeah.
That just really made me think, wow, there's something else to it. Because prayer is one of those things that I like family prayer. And that sort of thing where you're kind of talking to each other, expressing things, you know, special sentiments and feelings. But personal prayer, I didn't have a lot of, I don't know, that I feel like that kind of failed me. And so I'm a little cautious to go down this road, but I kind of want to, because that's what I felt as I listened to Phil talk about centering prayer and mindfulness is, you know, this kind of just a different way to pray compared to the way I have in the past. And I want to go there, but I'm a little nervous because I don't want it to be another disappointment.
Yeah.
So tell us about centering prayer.
Okay. The first thing I want to make a distinction. I do pray. I go through the motions of like very Mormon prayers. You know, put myself in a quiet spot, and I speak to God, and I speak out, you know, all my desires and my most of it is just desires for the people that I love. And so I kind of think of prayer now, like in the Mormon sense, as like a therapy session, right? Like a way to check in and know what it is that I'm wanting and needing, and also, you know, grateful for. So I do that, and that's separate. But very rarely do I have transcendent experience. In fact, I almost never do I have transcendent experiences through that process. I think it's a really healthy process and a really beneficial process, but it's not necessarily the way that I've ever truly accessed the divine. So Christian centering prayer is much more... there's a book I'm going to say... If anybody really wants to understand Christian centering prayer, there's a really great book by Cynthia Bregault, and she lays it all out. There's, of course, you know, a doctrine that kind of supports Christian centering prayer. It's a relatively new form of meditation. It was invented in early 1960s, but it's based in like the practices of Benedict monks. Is that the right? Is that how you say it?
Benedictine.
Yeah, Benedictine.
What's the book title?
Benedictine Monks. It's called Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. It's by Cynthia Bregault. And anyway, she takes this this type of meditation and she really lays it out for you. So it's really great for people who are really founded in Christianity because, of course, she ties it all back to Jesus. But it's also, just regardless of whether or not you're a believer, it has a really good anecdotal track record with helping people move past trauma or, just make huge changes in their life. So Okay, what is Christian-centered prayer? So it's a very, very
and specific... maybe differentiate it from mindfulness that some people might be familiar with.
Okay, so...
Or, yeah, just contrast those two.
Christian-centering prayer has a very different approach. And the best way that I can describe Christian-centering prayer in contrast with mindfulness is that mindfulness is like the act of receiving. And Christian-centering prayer is more the act of letting go. So in mindfulness, there's always kind of the intention to be able to gain, and I guess it would be a mindfulness of all things around you or your body or your true self or your quiet or just to claim awareness, mindfulness that of everything around you, this awareness. And Christian centering prayer is the flip side of that. It's more... it probably incorporates that a little bit, but it's more a releasing and a letting go and an outward flow of everything that you are into everything around you. So instead of receiving, you're more, it's more like an output. And you do it through very specific techniques. So the technique of Christian-centering prayer requires that you still your brain completely. So they say you should get in a very, very quiet place. Silence is really important and conducive to Christian-centering prayer. And they don't necessarily say that you have to get in any position. I actually lay flat on my back to do Christian-centering prayer. So it's more to be comfortable and to lack awareness of oneself. So you don't want to be aware of your body. You don't necessarily not want to be aware of your body. You just want to let it go. And then the goal is to still your mind or to clear your mind of thought or of anything. And there are kind of like these four tenets. I have my little book here. I'm going to read them. So the art of letting go would be to resist no thought, to retain no thought, react to no thought, return to the sacred word. So the idea is that you can't control what comes into your head because of the unconscious part of ourselves. And so the idea is to let the unconscious come, but just to let it flow right out of you. So instead of holding on to it, focusing on it, fixating on it in any way, just to let it flow out. And to not have any resistance to that flowing out. And also... through that process, you need kind of a way to do that. And so you're supposed to claim a sacred word. So everyone is supposed to, that practices Christian-centering prayer is supposed to go through the process of identifying their sacred word. And the only way that you really identify that is to go through the process of a meditative session and, identify a word beforehand that you might connect with and then use that word through the meditative session. So at any time that you realize that you have conscious thought, that you've focused on a thought, that you've let, that you've let a thought come in and you're fixating on it or you're looking at it from different sides or you've, let it wander, you use your sacred word and you say it in your mind to release the thought. So it's like the way that you trigger your brain and train your brain to let go and to release that thought out. And so it's very quiet, it's very peaceful, and it's very difficult. It takes tons and tons of practice and concentration. And I think actually that's why I love Christian-centering prayer, is because I feel like I'm really exercising that spiritual need that I have. I'm really struggling. And I've actually gotten really great results. And when I do it, when I'm disciplined enough to go through the motions of doing my Christian-centering prayer every day, I see huge benefits in my own life. And personally, I connect to it. So I think more than anything else, when I've tried lots of different types of meditation, and this is my language. I know other people who have tried Christian-centering prayer and absolutely loathe it, my husband being one of them. So it's not for everyone. And I think everybody speaks their own language of God. I think everybody has their own, you know, way of really connecting. And so it might not be everyone's cup of tea, but it is mine. I have tried, you know, a few different types of meditation and always kind of come away feeling like, I don't know, that didn't, you know, that doesn't seem to work for me. But the minute I tried this one, it was like I was home. I was like, oh, this is where this is my spiritual path, my watering hole for sure. This is where I can go. So it's very much me.
How long did it take you to feel like you were really encountering something, that you were getting results?
3 weeks of every day.
Okay.
And about 20 minutes. I think I got up to, at one point, like 28 minutes, and I started lower than that. I think I started at 10 minutes. But I have to say that, about 3 weeks in, I had a pretty profound spiritual experience. So, and I was surprised. I was very shocked and surprised. I mean, I knew I was getting better at just the releasing and the quiet, like the non-resistance, you know, the being able to just let my thoughts flow out of me. I was getting better and better at that control or lack of control. And then all of a sudden I had a powerful experience. And so that really, I was just surprising, and it was beautiful, and I felt really thrilled by it. And I haven't had another one. So just one, guys.
Well, that's great.
But I do find that it is very, very, it's just a wonderful way for me to start the day. It makes me feel calm. It makes me feel so much more capable. It helps with my depression. It's just very beneficial for me. And I just want to mention that the science of meditation is so solid, right?
Like, it's been beneficial beyond this one experience.
Other things. Okay. Yes. I just feel like in my life, it's really, really good for me. And they've studied and done all sorts of studies that people who meditate have greater capacity to have empathy and compassion for other people. They're more able to, you know, make decisions. They're calmer. They have, you know, better success in relationships, all sorts of wonderful things statistically that come about from people who are regular meditators. So,
well, that is a great experience that you've had, benefiting in a variety of ways, from persistently pursuing this practice. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
So Mike, how has your experience been different than Sarah's? Well, Sarah, real quick, how long have you been doing this off and on?
Yeah, off and on for a couple years. And
okay.
I have to be, I mean, in full disclosure, I go long periods of time where I get out of the habit, and then, but this is my home. So this is when I'm like, oh, I got to go back to meditating. This is where I come.
When you get in a depraved state.
Yeah, I come back to this.
Bring yourself back in.
Yeah,
okay.
This technique.
Okay. So Mike, what has your practice been like? How long have you been doing it? How consistent? What experiences have you had?
So what Sarah was describing is kind of where I started. So, I'm not someone that yells or screams or hits, but I get really up. I can get angry really quickly. So I get feisty. So a few years ago, you know, I was still trying to work things out at the church, and I'm talking with a young man I used to teach in preschool and stuff, and we eat together sometimes when he's in town. Kylan, he's the guy that did the remember when you guys did the Margaret Blair Young interview on A Thoughtful Faith? He was the young man that interviewed her. Anyways, he talked about meditation, and what I told him, I go, I just don't have time to do that. And he said, isn't that the point? And I thought, oh yeah. So I didn't think anything about it. And then I heard Phil McLemore on Mormon Matters, and he just sounded kind of too squishy to me. And then they had another one on him with him, and then he came back and he just gave one of his contemplative prayers and that he does during sacrament meeting. So I tried it. I was like, well, I can try that out. So I tried it out, and then I decided to go to his website, and then I I tried his free sessions, and I did a couple other sessions, and I found they were very helpful. And so that's where it started. And so basically the way and then from there I tried just meditation, but I think I'm going to go back to the contemplative prayer because it works. I like it better. But anyways, so this is kind of what I do. It's first thing in the morning. I try not to do anything else before I do this, so my mind like as clear as possible. And I'm trying different chairs to see what works best, but I found best is just a hard chair with a straight back. And I sit with my hands on my lap with my palms facing up. I try to relax, try to get a good posture. And then my goal is to empty my mind, is what it is. And so I'll have a mantra. And so initially when I first started doing it, what I would do actually was I would read a chapter from Psalms, and while I was reading it, I'd find like a verse in there that was short enough to do my mantra, and then I would do it that day. And then some of them I was writing down as well. And so the way I found for myself that worked the best was I'll say like part of the mantra as I breathe in twice, and then on the third breath I say it, and then I say the second part as I breathe out. And so the one like Phil McLemore does during sacrament meeting, which I actually do too in preparation for the horrible talks we'll be hearing, is it's an old Christian prayer. So as I breathe in, I say, "Come, Lord Jesus." And then I breathe out, and then I'll breathe in again. I'll say, "Come, Lord Jesus." And then on the third time, I'll say, "Come, Lord Jesus." And then as I exhale, I'll say, "Come." And so that's something straight from Phil McLemore. And what I visualize in my mind is I visualize part of my mind is on my spine and visualizing the breath coming up from my coccyx, from my tailbone, up to my back, to the back of my head, then to my forehead, and then as I exhale, it goes back the other way. So part of my mind is there, and then the other part of my mind is focused on my forehead, right above my eyes. And so that's kind of where I focus my thoughts as I say these mantras. And when I do it well, I can actually like completely empty my mind, but it doesn't last very long because my mind's like goes 1,000 miles a minute. Now, like Sarah, this happened only once. I think it happened probably about the third week too, Sarah. I wasn't doing it every day just because of work and stuff. So I was in the den, I was doing it, and all of a sudden I had this weird feeling, this weird thing happened. So I had this sensation that I had like dropped, but at the same time I had been elevated. And then my eyes are closed, and I saw just this blue color, like in front of my eyes, right, with my eyes closed. And it wasn't the sensation, you know, when you push on your eyeballs and you get like those mm-hmm. weird things. It wasn't like that. It was just like this blue color, and it was there for a while. I had this incredible feeling of peace and elevation, and then it started to go away. And I tried to chase it, and I had it back for just a second, and then it was gone. And I've never been able to have it back. And so I've chased it for a while, and then I finally decided, you know what? If I chase it, it's not going to come. So I just got to like just do my thing and see if it comes back. But my problem is I have a hard time stilling my mind, you know. And so I have so many thoughts that come in. And the next thing I know, I'm like attached to them, and then I'm like, oh wait. And then I kind of like try to, and then I put them away, and then I can do it again. And so, you know, usually my meditations are like 10 minutes maybe max. I did try a 45 minute one time, and yeah, it was just my mind was just like freaking all over the freaking place. And then one time I decided to wear my heart rate monitor that I wear when I exercise. So I put it on, and as soon as I felt like this really calming, I opened my eyes to see what my heart rate was, and it was like in the low 40s. It was really
wow.
Yeah, just like wow. It was really interesting. My heart is so there's like definitely a physiological aspect. Well, Brian, I was thinking like a guided meditation would be great, and so I thought so. I went on and I found this app called Headspace, and I liked it, and I've actually paid for a 1 month subscription. And he guides you through stuff, and so there's parts where like he'll be silent, but I found that during those silent moments that I'm still doing one of my Mormon mantras. And the one I do recently is actually from it's kind of a play on Gospel of John, because when I do the contemplative prayer meditation, I see it as a form of prayer. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was like I'm sitting there, you know, I have a good life, right? My kids are healthy. My wife generally likes me, although I'm in a bit of trouble for not doing the dishes yet. And so I'm like, I'm thinking I don't like really need anything. And so I started to view prayer kind of like, instead of talking to God, trying to be in their presence instead. And so that's kind of how I view it. Like instead of talking at them, I'm like trying to move in towards them, I guess, is the way. And so that's kind of how I view it. And so with that in mind, I was thinking about the idea of being like one with God and things like that. And so I kind of took John 17:21. And so then I go, as I, you know, I breathe and I say that I might be one, and I'll say that a few times. Then on the third X, I'll say, as you are one, like that is kind of my new mantra I've been doing, recently. And I find myself that if I'm thinking, okay, here's first time, second time, okay, third time I say the second part, that I can, my mind, at least I can keep it a little bit more focused on nothing, which is kind of a weird concept. Otherwise I'm like thinking about Facebook and, you know, and a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah. Can I add something to that? I just, cause you're talking about your Mormonists, I just want to like add the idea of adding like sacred space to meditation, because, and this is actually something that the temple is really useful for. And I feel like, you know, the temple creates a sacred space for people to go kind of naturally through meditative processes where they go to commune with the divine, but that, you know, whether they're praying or not, it just kind of lends itself to that meditative practices. So do you seek out a space when you do this, when you pray, or is it really random? Are you going somewhere? Or, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How does place come into?
Physical location space.
How does that come into your meditation?
So usually actually where I do it is in where I am right now on the futon in the den with some pillows behind me. It's where I normally do it. But I found that recently, because the way the futon sits, the bottom part slants back. My hips are a little flexed more than I like. So then just recently I started doing it on a hard chair just in the kitchen. But nobody's awake. I wake up like hours before anyone in my home wakes up.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of, and so that's kind of where I do it. Although there are times on Sundays where I don't get to it till everyone wakes up. And again, the den, I'm in the den, the door's closed, and everyone knows that I'm meditating. And then one thing I recently started doing is like kind of every so often, like if I have a thought of a person, I try to remember that afterwards, and then I kind of use that as a prompting to like reach out to them or just call them or send them a text message or something like that, you know.
Mind or like physically text them?
But no, physically text them or message them. Like just, hey, how are you doing? I haven't heard from you in a while, you know, type of a thing. And then usually what I do is I always read afterwards. And so right now I'm going through the Gospels. And so I'm in Luke right now. So after I do my meditation, I kind of sit there and then I'll read a chapter from the Gospel of Luke, for example.
So are you substituting your like Mormon kneel down at the side of your bed prayer for this new kind of prayer and meditation? It's like,
Yeah. Generally the Mormon prayer, typical Mormon prayer I do with my family.
Funny because I go through the Mormon prayer still. It's not funny, like all these years later through this whole process I'm still like saying my Mormon prayers.
Yeah.
I love them though.
No, it's not 100%. Sometimes, you know, I'll there have been times when like a thought's come to my mind of a person, and then I might say a prayer, you know, kind of focus on that person. But and I don't think it's any, I actually don't think my morning prayers, the typical morning prayers, I don't think I stopped them like purposely and substituted this. It's just like I've done it, then I read my scriptures and I'm like, okay, I gotta go now. You know, but there are moments when like there are moments when I'm like, oh, I haven't said prayer, and so I'll be in my truck on my way to work or something, and I'll, you know, say a standard prayer. But once again, in my mind, I'm like, I don't really need anything, and am I really changing God's mind by asking for these things? I don't know. I think just trying to move into their presence and just kind of trying to commune with them, and maybe something will pass to me that something I should do. That's kind of. That's how I view it.
That's really interesting. I definitely have a sacred space for both of my, I say my prayers in the shower. So like if I don't shower in the day, I don't say my prayers.
are these like singing prayers, like singing in the shower?
No, like I'm like, oh gosh, like I have to, for some reason I pray in the shower, and it's probably cause it's a function of being a stay-at-home mom. It's literally the only place in the house where you're not, like you can't hear them if they're like banging on the door because the water's on. Like I just feel completely like protected.
Yeah, and you have to lock the
from, like,
door.
Like that interference. Yeah, so you go in the bathroom, you lock the door, you turn on the fan, you turn on the water, and you have this alone time. And it's like the only part of the day where you truly like nobody has an excuse, right, to come in and who's going to? Because it's like, you know, my kids are getting to that age where they're like, oh, we know that that's mom's alone time. But so I go in the shower. I sit down in the shower, and I have changed, obviously, the way that I approach God. I don't actually say, like, Father in heaven anymore. I have a very, you know, just general term. I just say God. Mm-hmm. And so I address God, but it's like a way of talking out my intention and also my gratitude. So mostly my intentions are around other people, like to improve relationships that I have with other people, to, I was saying a mental text message, because I actually do go through those processes. I mm-hmm. speak intention to people in my prayer, like I send messages, and I know that's like super like metaphysical, but they've done actually like study. Have you read what is it? It's called The Fingerprints of God by Barbara. She's the religion beat person for NPR. Anyway, Fingerprints of God, great book. But she talks about studies that they've done where they put two people in different rooms and they hook them both up to these electrodes, and they're some form of lovers, whether they're, you know, like actual lovers or their mother, daughter, or siblings or whatever. They're intimately connected in some relationship. And then they flash pictures on a screen for one participant. And then when they flash a picture of the person in the other room, you know, of course, completely disconnected. There's no sound. It's sound and, you know, cut off and visually cut off. But when they see the picture of the person, they're supposed to think all the loving thoughts that they can about that person. And then they measure the physiology of the other person. And, like, they get great statistics of the other person responding physiologically.
Hmm. That sounds like the noetic sciences.
Yeah, yeah. But they can measure, like, the perspiration, you know what I mean, the body temperature, and so that's what they're looking at. It's just the changes, and they get pretty good statistics that when these people are thinking loving thoughts, they're, you know, simultaneously the other people will just, like, their physiology markers will do little things. So that's kind of, I mean, that kind of stuff, you know, I read that kind of stuff and I think, who knows? And so I actually do go through a lot of processes of just thinking loving thoughts through my prayers and kind of taking stock of relationships and stuff. But I'm really grateful for my LDS tradition of having regular check-in sessions with God. And I, you know, talk regular language to him and talk out my thoughts and go through that process. But, you know, I don't, like I said, that's generally not where I have my transcendent experience, but But it is sacred space for me. My shower is sacred space, and my bedroom floor is sacred space because it's where I do my meditation.
Those are great experiences. Thanks for sharing.
Do you have them, Brian? I want to know, like, what, I mean, I know you're not part of the...
No, I'm spiritually bereft.
Come on. Cough up.
So, well, if you had done your homework, which I know you haven't, and listened to the last one
I talked about... I listened to the first one.
Oh, okay.
I did.
Well, the second one, part two, I talk about movies.
Oh, yeah.
And... I think I mentioned this to you, Mike, when I watched Interstellar just a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I started bawling my eyes out.
Yeah.
And there were two conflicting things that shook me up. And one was this idea of large scale through time and space connectedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That I just really, really, really want. And, like, I want, you know, I want there to be a purpose to the universe. I want to exist, you know, beyond the next 50 years or however long I live. You know, that's something I really struggle with, is the existence of God and purpose to the universe and that sort of thing. And so that was really resonating with something that I want. But then this idea that he was in the right place at the right time and was doing like Morse code to talk to his daughter. And if she didn't get it, then, you know, it all would have fallen apart. That really frustrates me because it's this whole thing of like, you know, maybe all these doubts are keeping me from seeing the Morse code that I'm supposed to see, and I'm
really
screwed, and it's all going
to
fall apart.
You need to start doing meditation. Are you doing it?
No. I did a little bit. So I got one of those apps from Jon Kabat-Zinn that does, those guided meditations, and it's him, like, with a bell at the beginning, and then... he says, breathe, and then he says, wait for the bell, and it's like 10 minutes later, a bell goes off. And it's kind of funny. It must have been from the 90s or the 80s when he recorded it, because he says, at the end of the tape, turn it off. He didn't update it for MP3.
That's
so awesome. I did that for a little bit, but I just wasn't, I don't know, I was too busybody-ish to sit down and do it consistently, because that's the feeling I got from listening to Dan Weatherspoon talk about it and Phil McLemore, is you've got to do it for a little while, and at first it's going to blow.
Yeah,
That's totally true. Yeah, that's
so
true.
I never kept going with it, and I keep, like, every week I think, I need to do this. And when you were talking about sacred space, I have a lot of different feelings about that. Like, I went to a Catholic church once, and part of it, as I think, is the novelty of their mass.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when they were praying, you're in this big cathedral.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, I told you how I felt about prayer earlier, and it just felt like it was going out somewhere. You know, it just felt like it was more effective or something in that moment. I think it was part of the sacred space. And I was talking with this guy that he's been inactive forever, and he's returned, and he's almost zealot mode, but he's kind of lived the life, and he's done Buddhist meditation at different times, and he says, you know, our church is actually really good for meditation. And I'm like, man, our chapels are lame. What are you talking about? And he was talking about the starkness of it, that there's no distraction.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh, I guess that's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
So
I've never thought of church as a sacred space ever, but I definitely thought of the temple as my sacred space. I just, the church provided that so well. It was like, hey, you need a place to go and commune with God. Here we've provided this big, huge building, and then we put you in a bunch of clothes, and you're warm, and you sit down in a beautifully, like, comfortable chair, and we turn the lights out, and then you think about God.
Yeah.
I finally had to, like... Oh,
and
yeah.
And it's the cosmic narrative.
Yeah,
you know?
And then it's just like, you know, of course you're contemplating, like, big ideas, and you're, you know. But yeah, I think I am the same way. Like, I love to go into other churches, and it's really easy for me to identify my sacred space there. But yeah, I think you'd like actually meditative practice, but I definitely think you have to kind of be willing to go through the trial and error of finding the one you like.
Well, listeners, I hope you liked that. If you are in need of something new, perhaps meditation is what will fill your cup. Maybe I'll even give it a fair shot this time around. As for next week, you can look forward to another part in the Very Human Mormon Mind series, where Misha, Ben, and I discuss the illusion of asymmetric insight. Look forward to that, and until then, keep keeping it weird.